Well, thank you, David. That's a splendid introduction to not only this evening, but probably the next few weeks as you go around and visit the various exhibits. I've been asked to come and talk about the sounds of the city, and I don't know whether the organizers were aware of the fact when they asked me that I left the city in 1975, and I have never returned. I went to live in the country, which is where I still live and prefer to live, largely because of the confusion and the noise that cities were beginning to develop. I do, however, travel quite a bit, and I travel to cities. When I travel to cities, very often I think of myself as a tourist, an oral tourist, if you want, because I listen to the sounds of cities and how they change. You know, many of the metaphors that we have are still visual metaphors, I'm sure, in most languages. We talk about, I'd love to see Prague, or I hope to live to see Istanbul. But in fact, when we go to visit these cities, very often we're jostled by all other kinds of sensorial information. You smell the goulash in Germany or Austria, and you can smell the cappuccino. You can hear the scraping chairs in Milan. You can hear the church bells in Salzburg. These are not things that are normally in the tourist brochures. If you look at the tourist brochures, you won't find very much that is auditory or even in terms of the other senses. And yet those are some of the things that we bring back, the memories that we bring back. The city that I left in 1975 was Vancouver. And I was teaching at Simon Fraser University at that time in a communication department. And in 1975, I had just gone to Vancouver, and I felt that Vancouver was a much noisier city than other cities that I'd lived in. I actually went from St. John's, Newfoundland, directly to Vancouver. The reason for that, I think, is that they had less severe weather, and therefore they don't have as much insulation in their buildings, houses and other buildings as well. Therefore, there's a lot more seepage of noise in through the walls of the buildings, and you can become quite disturbed by that. And I became very disturbed by the noise in Vancouver, and I initiated a course in noise pollution at Simon Fraser University. It was not successful. The students said, well, so the city's noisy. What do you want us to do about it? We had people come in and speak about various aspects of noise, but it was quite clear that we were somehow at the mercy of the noise that was invading cities at that time. And there was seemed like there was nothing positive that we could do. I then had what I think was an inspiration to suggest that we don't just study the noises of the city, but we study what I called the soundscape. And that was a word that I invented. And by that I meant all of the sounds of the city, all of the sounds of the whole environment in and out of the city, so that when you study them all together, then you'll certainly discover what sounds are offensive, what sounds are interesting, what sounds you would like to retain, what sounds you would like to eliminate. The first publication that we came up with was a publication called The Vancouver Soundscape. And it consisted of two long-playing records and a book. The book is here. Unfortunately, it's not available anymore, which is unfortunate because it has most of the information. The recorded examples that we recorded at the time is available, but I will pass the book around. You can just pass it as we talk, and look at some of the pictures and look at some of the diagrams. Vancouver is a relatively new city, and was officially incorporated in 1886. And this really made it possible for us in 1970 to go back to its origins as a settlement. And, of course, the first inhabitants were the Coast Salish Indians who were there. And some of them were still alive. Many of them were still alive when we were able to interview them about sounds in the past. The first white settlers were loggers, trappers, and they were very quickly followed with the development of the first Trans-Canada Railway, so that by 1910, the population of Vancouver was up to 100,000 people. When we were doing our research, it was still possible to interview people who remembered life in the early days of the city. We would call these ear witness accounts, just like eyewitness, people who had observed things from the past. And, you know, when we go back to the days before the introduction, the invention of the tape recorder and recording in general, that's the only way we can get an impression of what the soundscape was like, is through ear witness accounts. Either people who are describing in letters, in novels, in poems, in other documents, the sounds that are around them. And this is the only way that we can have an impression of not only what the sounds were, but also what people's reactions to those sounds were, whether they liked those sounds or whether they disliked those sounds. We, of course, were able to start to make some recordings, and I'll play you a couple of examples in a moment. And at that time, very few people had ever taken a microphone out of a studio. Ornithologists, bird collectors, sometimes took the microphone out in order to record birds. And sometimes anthropologists or ethnomusicologists took microphones out in order to record sounds, particularly the sounds of people singing songs in remote parts of the world and so forth. But I think we were probably the first people to take a microphone out of the studio and to put it out in the environment at various places and to record sometimes just all the sounds that were there without having a particular opinion about what we wanted to record. And I would say that, therefore, our recordings, to a large extent, were unmediated. They were not intended to record specific things. Yes, sometimes we did take a microphone and try to record a particular signal, a particular sound. But much of the time, we simply put microphones out and recorded what was there in order to see, for instance, the circadian curve of activity and quiet in a city over a 24-hour period. I think that what you could call maybe phenomenological recording is something that we invented as part of the Vancouver soundscape activity. Now, Vancouver is a city of, it's what I would call a wood and water culture. You know, most of the sounds that existed at that time and prior to our time there, had some relationship to water. Ships, of course, obviously, but also activities that took place close to water, where water was sounding. The wood, of course, was the original material that the city of Vancouver was fashioned from. So the sound of the adze, the saw, the woodworking materials were the sounds that people would have lived with in the early days of the city. And even the sidewalks in Vancouver up until the 1930s, 1940, they were of wood. So that you had an additional sort of sound that came as you walked with boots and high-heeled shoes and so forth over wooden sidewalks, not cement sidewalks, wooden sidewalks, which resonated because they were raised above the earth, above the mud of the street. And then, of course, walking into houses that were made of wood, and the resonance that you get in those houses is very different from the resonance you get in a cement or brick house. And I think you could talk about different cultures having different primary materials, and that those primary materials influence the sound of that culture. You know, by contrast, you could say that Southern Europe is a stone culture. You could say that the Middle East is a pottery and a sand culture, or that traditional Japan is a paper and bamboo culture. That means that paper and bamboo are used a great deal in Japanese culture, and you're going to hear the sounds that they make as they resonate. So with every one of these cultures in different parts of the world, you have a different collection of sounds. Among these sounds are not always listened to. Among these sounds, you'll find some that are heard maybe as background sounds, not listened to consciously. I'm not suggesting for a moment that everyone in Vancouver listened to the sound of their boots as they walked down the wooden plank sidewalks. In fact, I was looking for a term. How do you describe sounds that people don't listen to, and yet they're there? And I came up with the notion that we might call them keynote sounds. You know, it's a musical term. A keynote in a composition is the key in which the piece is written. It doesn't mean that the piece always stays in that key. It can modulate, it can go somewhere else, but somehow everything that it does will still relate to the key from which it began and to which it will eventually return at the end. So when we talk about keynote sounds, we're talking about sounds that are not really heard, but maybe overheard. And one of the interesting things is that, you know, there are so many examples of never having listened carefully to keynote sounds. I was reading Constance Klassen's book that David Howes just mentioned, The Book of Touch. And the other day, and she talks about the word to write being etymologically derived from to scratch. And, of course, it's true that quill pens or any kind of writing device, you're scratching the parchment, you're scratching the paper. It makes a sound, or it certainly made a sound when in the past, when people were scratching with quill pens. And yet, I have never come across a description of all the writers that I have read, and I've read lots of novelists of the 18th, 17th, 18th, 19th century looking for sound quotations and so forth. I have never come across a single instance of a writer saying he heard the sound of his own pen. Now, that would be maybe a keynote sound from another era. Do we have keynote sounds today? Well, of course we do. We have the sounds of electricity. We have the hums of electricity. We have ventilation equipment and so forth, computer peripherals. And in this room, for instance, there are sounds that have been present in this room before any of us entered it, and they're still present, but we've probably ignored them. Until I draw your attention to them, and then you can hear them, right? You hear that the room is vibrating with something that we intend not to listen to. Strangely enough, you know, the 60-cycle hum that we have in North America, you know, in Europe they have 50 cycles. The difference between that, musically speaking, would be that that 60 cycles would be B natural in the musical scale, and 50 cycles is about a G sharp. Right? And sometimes I do a relaxation exercise with students. I try and get them to relax, relax, relax. I won't go through the whole procedure. But then I lie on the floor and relax, and the whole body becomes an ear, you know, and you're just listening. And then I would ask them to hum the sound of prime unity, or give it whatever name you want, some magic sort of formula. Hum the sound that seems to come from the center of the universe or the center of your body or whatever. And on many occasions, in North America, they'll start to hum 60 cycles. And in Europe, they'll start to hum 50 cycles. So what does that mean? It means you carry around a memory trace of some of these keynote sounds, these sounds that we don't listen to consciously. We are still being infected in some way, unconsciously. Well, in addition to that, and much more prominently, we have what we would call signals. In every society, we have certain prominent sounds, and they indicate things. They indicate our deportment in many ways. You have the signals of your cell phone, and those are private signals. There are other signals that are public signals, like the signal to cross a street or stop or whatever like that. Some cities have them now, especially for blind people or people that aren't paying attention. And one very prominent signal that we have in Canada is railroad crossings. And anyone who has been listening to trains passing, and I assume that many of you have heard trains pass by, may recognize the signal for a level crossing. But I'm not sure how many of you could sing it for me if I asked you to. But the signal for a level crossing is two longs, a short, and a long. Bom, 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 bom. That's one of a code of 33 signals that's used still in the railroad business. But the others we don't hear, because the only one that we would normally hear would be the level crossing sort of signal. Did you know also, just incidentally, that all the horns on Canadian trains are tuned? They're all tuned to the same frequency. The frequency is 311 hertz. That's an E flat on your musical scale. And how many tones in the Canadian whistle? Anybody know? One, two, three, four. Is it a chord? Is it a single horn or what? Well, there's three. it's a triad. It's a minor triad on an E flat minor triad on 311 hertz. And we hear that from coast to coast in Canada. And if you hear a whistle in Canada that is a one-tone whistle, it's not a Canadian engine, it's an American one. We sometimes hear them, actually. So maybe you'll listen next time. Some of these signals, you know, they have to be heard. They have to be recognized. I'm going to play you a little collection that we made in Vancouver when we were doing our recording of signals that were prominent in Vancouver at that time. Whistles from factories and so forth, along with a number of trains, a number of boat whistles signaling. Quite an interesting collection, because some of them are air horns and some of them are steam whistles. And some of them you will now probably recognize as being rather antique sounding, even 30 years later. Could we have that example?
Yeah.
of these signals are indicating something, whether they're attracting your attention, whether they're ships giving signals to other ships, whether they're trains indicating that they're approaching a crossing or that they're doing something or other. Even the case of the last signal, the noon whistle on the top of the BC Hydro building went off every day at 12 o'clock. Now, if a sound manages to survive in an environment for a number of years, it generally tends to become, it has a romantic attachment for many of the people who live there, because it's like an anchor from their own place. And people have often said to me, oh, when I hear the sound of something or other, I know I'm home again. I love that sound. It could be anything. It could be just the sound of a whistle on a factory at a suitable distance. It could be the sound of the noon whistle in the BC Hydro. In fact, one of the sounds that was most loved in Vancouver was the sound of the diaphone foghorn. When we took surveys of people as to which sounds they liked. You know, if you were looking at a medieval city, you'd see that certain buildings obtruded over the general skyline, and it would be, the castle and the church. These were the taller buildings. Well, it's the same thing in any soundscape. There are going to be certain signals that have to be higher in level and volume than the general ambient noise levels, and these become signals. Now, if they've stayed around long enough, they begin to become what I would call sound marks. Sound marks are like landmarks. You know, visually, we have landmarks. We have old churches. We have old buildings. We want to hold on to them. They're part of the history of the city. We also have sound marks that have been there for a good long time, and a lot of people respect them and want to keep them. Now, one of the problems, of course, with sound marks is that it depends on a constant population with constant attitudes, because if the population changes, what might be a sound mark, a very affectionately regarded sound for some people, might become unpleasant for people of a later generation. A perfect example of that, and this is a phenomenon that is not only in Canada, but of course in Europe as well, is church bells. Church bells that were the loudest sound was heard in the medieval city, inside the gates, and they were heard frequently, day and night. It's only recently they've begun to become prosecuted for creating too much noise that never would have been considered noise in the great days of the Catholic Church, but now it is. So there is a change there that is taking place as we speak, and there are probably some changes in Vancouver as well. That sound, that Hydro sound that you heard, was actually discontinued for a period of time due to objections. And I think I heard one or two people laughing when it was heard here. And it's true. I think it's rather corny. But heard at a suitable distance, the sharp edges of it tend to get rounded, and maybe it has a certain evocative quality. I'm going to play you an example of the same hydro horn recorded several kilometers away, and then follow it with two other sound marks from Vancouver that are still present. One is the 9 o'clock gun, which is shot from Stanley Park every night at 9 o'clock, and they've been shooting that one off since, I think, 1850 or something. And then the bells of Holy Rosary Church, Catholic Cathedral in Vancouver. So here are three sound marks from Vancouver. And let the bells run on for a little bit so that you can hear the changes. That is what's called change ringing. Those three sound marks from Vancouver, the one that has disappeared is the change ringing. It is performed by nine men, actually pulling on the cords of the bells themselves. So it's physically, it's very difficult. And of course, they have to get the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 1, 3, 4 times. They do the different changes. And when you hear them, when you go up in the belfry, as we did and recorded, not that recording, but we've been up in the belfry, and they call out, the change, the nine people then start pulling in a totally different fashion. It's very beautiful to watch as they change from one thing to another. But of course, it takes human energy to do and human dedication to learn to do the change ringing, and that's one thing that we've lost, whereas the electronic things have survived. The we'll pass back in a way for a moment to the question of noise. Sometimes I'm asked, has the city become noisier since you did these recordings? Well, noise pollution, of course, is a worldwide problem, and it's being taken much more seriously now than it was. I thought it was interesting, for instance, that a pamphlet was just handed to me recently. You may have seen this one, Montreal Airports, and it's called Managing the Soundscape. They have taken this, well, I should have copyrighted the word, but I didn't. Anyway, they've taken this neutral word and have used it instead of saying managing the noise around airports, which is what they're really doing. They take a more positive approach, and of course, to a large extent, they have done a great deal to reduce the sound of jet aircraft, not necessarily in Montreal, but the manufacturers have been forced to reduce the sound so that every new generation of jet aircraft is 1 or 2 decibels quieter than the previous planes. And at the time when we were in Vancouver, of course, that was during the 60s. The jets just came in the 60s. 1960, and there was a terrible furor, some of you may remember, about the noise of aircraft, especially the new jets, and the noise profile of the airports just exploded into the community, because of the increased sound of those planes. And then the Concorde was being planned as well, and that was going to be even noisier than anything that existed at the time. So there was a lot of campaigning against noise, and the response of cities was to say, okay, we're going to investigate this. So they go out and they hire acoustical engineers, and the acoustical engineers are given thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars to go around and put meters various places in the city and measure the ambient noise level and come back with what really just amounts to a report, And I thought, well, if you want to really find out whether the city's getting noisier, this is a simple way to do it. You have certain signals in the city that always must be heard above the ambient noise level, otherwise they wouldn't function properly. So what you do is you go and you measure those things going back into the past. We took, for instance, the sound of sirens on police cars and fire engines. And we went back and we measured right back to 1912, and we measured the first siren that was used in Vancouver was a siren called La France. And it measured 88 to 96 decibels at 10 meters. And then we took the next siren, and the next one, and the next one, and we went right up to 1965. And 1970, in fact, the siren peaked at 114 decibels at 10 meters. So that would be an increase of 20 to 25 decibels in 60 years. And it's a fair guess to say that the the ambient noise level of the city kept pace with that. That's why they had to increase the level of the sirens. Of course, I tried to get various administrations to let me advise them on this, but they didn't really want to, because, you see, I was actually solving the problem, whereas the acoustical engineers were not solving anything. All they were doing was piling up statistics, and it took them years and years to get all the statistics together. And, of course, meanwhile, the administrators at City Hall could say, whenever the noise complaints came in, yes, I agree with you, and we're having a noise study being conducted just at this moment. It will be completed in 3 years, and then we'll be able to act. And of course, once it's completed, then you start another study. The British government in 2004, just came in the other day, intends to spend £13 million to make a noise map of Britain, in preparation for a national noise strategy. Okay, £13 million. What could you do with that to actually solve a problem rather than simply measuring it? You know, what will you have at the end? All you'll have is a noise map. And then in 2 years, it'll be out of date anyway. So I'm not very, you know, very keen on what's happening in terms of urban administrations everywhere and camouflaging the real issue of noise. But I don't want to sound too pessimistic, because I'm not sure, if you were to ask me my personal opinion, whether the city now is noisier than it was in 1970 when I concluded that study. I think I would say probably not, but there are certain definite signs of the sounds of cities have changed. One of the main sounds that's changed, I think, is that we now recognize that construction and deconstruction is going to be permanent in cities. That there's no longer a question of the city being built once and then standing silently, like the great cities of Europe and other parts of the world, where the city, you know, is built, the cathedral is built, and then the cathedral remains. What we're going to see a great deal more of is cities in which buildings go up and buildings come down, and buildings go up and they come down. Already, I think we have architects who are beginning to see some of their earlier buildings being knocked down. Some quite famous buildings, unless I'm mistaken, are beginning to be considered, redundant, not perhaps large enough for the space or whatever, and they're going to be brought down and rebuilt. So the sound of rebuilding of cities, I think, is going to. That's one of the perhaps the major ailments of the city right now, is that we're going to have to cope not only with the noise, but also with the dust, with the inconvenience, with the torn-up roads and everything else that has to take place when we reconstruct a city. It's almost as if architecture has kind of gained the fluidity of music, you know, that it's got a very sort of heavy bass and percussion section, you know, that's going on all the time. Also, internally, internally, it seems to me, and this is again just pretty subjective, I haven't really measured anything in recent years, but it seems to me that the physical plant of modern buildings is getting louder. There's a lot more infrasound, a lot more deep vibration. And if you put your ear against the wall anywhere,
you'll hear it.
It's pretty obvious. I guess if you put your ear against the wall of the church up there on St. Catherine's, you wouldn't hear it, because there's nothing going on behind that wall. But in modern buildings, there is. So that infrasound is, I don't know what the consequences of anything like that might possibly be, whether it stimulates more regular bowel movements or just what it does. But one interesting twist that happened as a result of our recording and our writing about the soundscape was that these recordings began to become historically interesting. And there were a number of people, for instance, in some of these factories where you heard the factory whistles, and they said, you know, we don't have the whistle anymore, it's gone. And can we have the recording? We want it for our archives. We want it, to keep it. It's a historical. It's a sound object. It's just like having a photograph of the old building itself. So there's a great deal of nostalgia now for those kinds of sounds that were recorded in the past, and we realize that what used to be simply photography, a visual record of what we've done, now we want to have an oral record, and perhaps we want to have other kinds of records as well of what we have experienced in the past as we've gone through various periods of history. The other thing that happened is that a lot of these recorded soundscapes began to be regarded as art. And it started actually in Germany. A quite famous German producer, radio producer by the name of Klaus Schoening at the West German Radio in Cologne. He played the whole of the Vancouver soundscape recording as if it were a new kind of composition, a musical composition that we'd put together. And he got so excited about it that he then commissioned more city portraits from by composers in London, New York, Venice, Berlin, San Francisco, Benares, Lisbon, and Barcelona. So there began to become a whole kind of treasury of recordings, soundscape recordings, and you'll see them, they're around now. You can go into record stores, or you can join clubs, and you can get all kinds of soundscape recordings from composers all over the world, of urban and rural and other kinds of events. Some of them, of course, we did a lot of 24-hour recordings, and we did them outside in nature in order to show the circadian rhythms and how they changed. Well, now you can go and buy nature recordings, listen to the sounds of the birds or the insects and the rain and the other things as well. And I think we stimulated a lot of that activity very much with the recordings that with the recordings that we did. However, my purpose and our purpose was not to make works of art, but to simply provide ourselves with a catalog of information, sound information that we could measure. And all of our recording, of course, was also accompanied by measurement with sound level meters in decibels and so forth. So we were regarding it more scientifically. But today, I think there's that real tendency, to regard some of these things more artistically than was originally the intention, or perhaps the value of them. The problem, I think, with recording generally, this is just a comment, is that the recordist is always outside the environment. You know, it's the same with photography. The person taking the picture is not in the scene. The person taking the picture is out of the scene. And in recording, the person who is actually doing the recording is making certain selections. And then with the techniques of montage and crossfade and so forth, you can fashion a sound object and make it into an artistic product. And you can bring certain things like irony into the montage technique. I heard a soundscape recording recently in which someone had the sound of monks singing and bleating sheep montaged together. Well, that's making a commentary, isn't it? We never tried to do anything like that. We simply tried to collect information. The Vancouver soundscape was not the only document we produced. We then went on and we did some work in Europe and produced some other documents as well. I left the project in 1975, as I mentioned, and since that time, there has been an increasing amount of interest in the soundscape, and particularly, of course, urban soundscapes. We now do have a World Forum for Acoustic Ecology, The World Forum consists of country member nations. There are probably a dozen nations now that are in the World Forum for Acoustic Ecology. Canada is one of them since we started it. Japan is a very large member. They have 500 members in their soundscape community, the Japan Soundscape Association. Australia, the United States is beginning to have one. Finland is very strong. Austria, Germany, Switzerland is quite strong. So there's a large and growing community of people who are concerned now with recording and preserving and changing and transforming and studying the soundscape. And there is a journal called The Soundscape, appropriately enough. And I have three copies of it, which I will leave here, and maybe you can put them in the library, and if anyone is interested in reading about them. Some of the activities of some of the member nations in the World Forum for Acoustic Ecology are really quite interesting. I'll just tell you about one of them. The Japanese decided that they would try and open what they were doing, their research, to the general public and get more publicity for themselves. And so they conceived the idea of asking people to nominate the 100 most beautiful soundscapes in Japan. And this went out, and they got thousands and thousands of people saying, you know, one of the most beautiful soundscapes is the sound of. And in many cases, these were natural sounds, of course, perhaps a particular beach that had certain shells on that beach that were not found anywhere else. And when the waves came and went over these shells, you had a sound that was quite different and distinctive and not heard anywhere else in Japan. I know that another one of the sounds that was nominated was the sound of silkworms. I didn't even know that there was a sound of silkworms, but apparently there is. And the interesting thing is that they went to visit all of these different locations that were nominated, some of them urban, some of them rural, and they chose the 100 best soundscapes in Japan, and they published a brochure about it, and it goes out with tourist literature, and tourists now go to particular places to hear one of the 100 most beautiful sounds in Japan. And not only that, but the local communities, some of these were small communities and so forth, have now put up monuments announcing that they have been selected as one of the most beautiful soundscapes of Japan. And you see, what will happen, ideally, what will happen from that is that those places will now become protected, environmentally protected, so that if you want to put a cement factory next to the most beautiful sound in Japan, you'd be prevented from doing so by public, by the public and so forth. So I think we're making some progress in terms of bringing, not just silencing the noise of the world, but bringing back perhaps a real feeling for the aesthetics, improving the aesthetic. Because he felt it in something that he'd been saying all along. And as we moved, from a visually concentrated society to a more auditory society. And so he actually wrote a very nice review of The Tuning of the World when it was published. He was a person who influenced a lot of my thinking, certainly, as he did many of us. The question that you're asking is just a general question, and I can't really comment on what is happening today because I'm not at the center of the research that's going on. As I told you, I left the university, and in 1975, and I'm not really very interested in what goes on in universities or cities at the moment. But so I think it's a subject for someone else. But you're absolutely right. Our perceptions are constantly changing. And I think, as David Howe suggested, there is such a turbulence now of interest in the other senses other than just the visual sense that we were all brought up to regard as being the primary sense, that there is, you know, we are going to be changing. We are going to be thinking more in terms of tactility. We are going to be thinking more in terms of sound. And we're going to become more critical, I hope, of some of the things that offend the other senses. I mean, one of the things, for instance, it's not exactly an answer to your question, but it just occurred to me. In modern architecture, practically all the surfaces that you touch are flat. They have very little tactile sort of sensation to them. You go back to the old bricks, mortar, stones, and wood carvings and so forth. Go to an old church somewhere. There are some of them, some beautiful ones here in Montreal. And immediately you're into a much more tactile environment, right? The things that you want to, you feel you want to touch those carvings, you want to touch those that woodwork and so forth, so that's something that maybe will change in architecture. Maybe in architecture we're going to come into an era in which tactility will again become a feature of the architecture, because people will want it. You know, the difference between walking across this, there's no sensation on the feet. And that's why I took my students out the other day and said, let's walk around the campus. Take your socks off, take your shoes off, and walk around. And to my surprise, many of them held hands and walked with their eyes closed so they could really sense the campus. And when they came back into the class 15 minutes later, they came back, and there was not a single sound. No one spoke. I was amazed. I was honestly amazed that that sensation was that strong for those students, that they actually felt, you know, this thing that they'd never felt before on the soles of their feet, the dampness of the grass, the stones, the sand, the cement, the walking up the stairs and so forth to get into the class again. And so just that sensory experience was a very strong experience for them. And I think these are the kinds of things that are going to be happening, you know, in the future, as the senses perhaps, you know, they some of them become enhanced and others perhaps become neglected again. Sorry, yes. Well, they're two different things, aren't they? One's a psychological tolerance to certain things of your choice, and the other one is just a physical, thing. We do know that sounds of certain amplitude heard consistently can be deafening, and you begin to lose your hearing. And it used to be called presbyacusis when you begin to lose your hearing. And it was thought that it was just something that was natural. It just happened as we get older, like we get gray hair and we get wrinkles and so forth. We begin to lose our hearing. Well, there was an otologist, a New York otologist, went and did a study with the Maban tribe in Africa. I think they were in... I can't just remember which country now, but anyway, he gave an audiogram to everybody in that tribe, and he showed that people at the age of 75 and 80 had the same hearing acuity of people with people that were 20. So there was no deterioration in their hearing. And his assumption was that it was because they were living in such a quiet environment. No mechanical noises, no sounds above 85 decibels to bother them. It's been contested, that particular study, by people who said, well, how do you know? There might have been other factors. Perhaps it was something they ate or that gave them that immunity. But when we're talking about noise, we're talking about a physical problem, which can affect all of us and perhaps has already affected many of us in this room with a certain loss in our hearing ability. Then the psychological question of whether you like something or not is something very different. And I don't know of any studies that have been done to show that blacks prefer, they can tolerate loud noise more than other people. It would be psychological if it were true. Of course, Carl Jung thought that the blacks were just a noisier race anyway, because they talked more and they liked to have more sound around them than some other races. But you're talking about maybe the prejudice of a Swiss man, a Swiss German, against people who are a little noisier than the Swiss Germans are, and they're not very noisy. So. Yes.
Things, yo, hello. Things, that's for Carl Jung and everyone who loves hip-hop. But it just seems to me like the rise in digital sound of all kind. And I was interested by what you said about how in Europe electricity runs on a 50 cycle and we seem to have a sort of unconscious memory of that and it's affecting us. And here in North America it runs on 60. And I'm wondering if you think that the rise of digital sound will in some way, what sort of, I know you're not right in the center of the research right now, as you're saying, but what sort of effect that might have on the range of our listening or the way that we listen?
Yeah, well, I said I wasn't at the center of the research, and that's true. I think there's a lot of research that should be conducted on that very problem. You've identified an interesting issue that could be studied. Yeah, definitely. You should do it.
I always bring those earplugs in my purse, and I'd like to know if there are many people in the room who do the same.
Many people who... I didn't hear the last part.
Carrying earplugs.
Wearing earplugs. Oh.
Carrying them,
yes. Put up your hands, anyone who normally carry earplugs with you when you're in the city. My hand goes up as well. I sleep with them every night in Montreal since I've come here. I think it's something that an increasing number of people are finding necessary to travel with and to be able to put them in. Perhaps you can enter into environments now with such intense noise. It could be a dress shop. even. It could be a restaurant or a bar. It could be, you know, another place that you wouldn't necessarily expect to have an intensity of sound that could be potentially hazardous, but I'm afraid that is a fact. We have an enormous appetite for noise. Our culture has an enormous appetite for noise. You know, we produce the loudest music that was ever produced. There's no doubt about that. And that's recreational. And I don't just mean rock. I don't mean heavy metal either. If you look at the history of Western music, it was getting louder, you know, throughout the 18th and 19th centuries. And the orchestra was expanding, and we were getting more and more instruments in the orchestra, so that the power of the orchestra was becoming more and more sensational. And that's what people seem to want. And then you get into amplification, and you get you know, all kinds of additional problems associated with that, in addition to creating perhaps an appetite that we have now for louder sound than people did in the 19th century. There are signs, however, I think there are signs among interested people in reducing the amount of noise waste. You know, noise is waste. I'm talking about wasted sounds, sounds that are unnecessary. I'm not talking about whether you like to listen to your music at a loud volume or not, but if you simply go out on the street and stand on the street corner, 90% of the sound that you listen to there is wasted noise. It's escaped energy. I mean, if you could make a silent car, it'd be much more efficient. You know that. Because you wouldn't be wasting all that energy in dispersing it in the form of noise. You'd be using it where it ought to be used, to make the car run more efficiently. And so I think there are a lot of people maybe starting to concern themselves with that. So I'm relatively hopeful about cities in, with regard to the future. Perhaps with a certain amount of education, we can also bring ourselves to a point where our appetite for loud sound is not quite as extreme as it has been up to now. I mean, certainly we've reached a kind of point of reductio ad absurdum. If you go to a heavy metal concert and listen to sounds of 115 decibels and have a temporary threshold shift when you leave that concert, and any otologist will tell you that a temporary threshold shift that happens in your hearing, if it happens too frequently, you'll have a permanent threshold shift within very few years, and there's no cure for it. So that's a message, I think, that we need to get out to younger people.
One more question.
At the very back.
I'm very interested in what you just said about automobiles. I'm part of a municipal political party called Projet Montréal, and one of our formal offerings on our program is actually reducing the sound in the city. So I would be very much interested in knowing what kind of measures you would suggest in terms of reducing the sounds of the city, the sounds that are negative.
Well, you know, one of the things we should think about is that, and this is what's new in the soundscape, is that most of the sounds that you listen to in cities are owned by someone. They're owned by someone. There's more and more copywriting of sounds and being used by people for rhetorical purposes, you know, to sell their own products or whatever. And I don't just mean advertising and jingles and things like that, which are pretty obvious. But, for instance, the sound of an automobile can be proven to be a copyright that is owned by the manufacturer of that automobile. And some of you probably heard about the famous case of Harley-Davidson taking Honda to court to sue them because they were duplicating the sound of the Harley-Davidson automobile. And when I was in Germany a few years ago, in Munich, I was approached by the people at the BMW plant in Munich, and they said, "Mr. Schaefer, we want to discuss with you the new BMW automobile, the sound it will make. What we want, Mr. Schaefer, is that when you're standing on the street and a BMW approaches you from behind, you say, "Ah, I think I hear the sound of a BMW." Now, Mr. Schaefer, what is that sound? And they paid me a lot of money every day, and they gave me a BMW to drive around in. But unfortunately, I was not able to come up with the sound that they wanted. But you see, what I'm saying is that there are a lot of automobile manufacturers and other people that are making products, refrigerators and other things that generate sound. The same thing is happening with refrigerators, by the way. Refrigerator manufacturers want a sound in the refrigerator that when you walk past the refrigerator, you're going to say, "Ah, I think I want a beer." You know, you'll turn to the refrigerator. You'll use the refrigerator. I mean, they want you to use it. So there's a lot of that activity now taking place in the world. And there's going to be more. There's no doubt about that. Rights to stomach is something that used to be talked about. You know, where within a certain territory you could only sell Coca-Cola. So Coca-Cola had the rights to your stomach. You know, in that area, or McDonald's or whatever. You're going to find maybe in a future society, that there's going to be certain territories where you will only hear certain copyright sounds by certain people who've paid a lot of money in order that you won't be able to hear anybody else's competitive sound. It's just a thought to end the talk on. Thank you.